Weak English.
Welcome to the Visual Storytelling Podcast. My name is Fred Ranger, and I'm so happy that you're joining us this week for another very inspirational conversation. Today is a special day because I have actually a friend of mine on the podcast. He's also a director of photography, a very talented photographer, and an all-around great guy. We have Luca Rupnik on the show today. So Luca, first of all, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing good.
Great.
Getting into the spring mood, so looking forward to some sunshine.
Yeah, man. We've been chatting a lot over the past few weeks about going out and shooting and so on and so forth. And we haven't delivered on that, so we have to make sure that we do go out in Montreal and go shoot together. But first of all, Luca, for the people on the show who don't know you, can you walk us through a bit of how you found photography and why you decided to invest time, effort, and make it your job, basically?
For me, it's a pretty obvious road to photography. My father was a photographer. He was a medical photographer, so he worked at the University of Montreal when I was young, and then later on at the General Hospital. So, you know, when I used to go to see my dad at work, I'd hang out in a dark room and watch him develop pictures. He documented our whole family life on film. So there's boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes of negatives, films, photos of you know, our whole life. But I mean, I just, through him, you know, obviously gained an appreciation of image, of photography too, because he's a big fan of movies, and like we watch, you know, I watched movies way earlier than I ever should have when I was a kid, but in a nice way. They're always well, you know. I think I watched The Godfather when I was 6. I watched Jaws when I was 7. But it was never weird, you know. But it was always movies, lots of Hitchcock movies and stuff like that. So like image and these things were always accessible to us. Like, you know, we always had cameras. We had a video camera when I was, I think, 6 or 7 years old, which was this Panasonic thing where you had to carry around the VCR with you. So you had like a shoulder strap with like a half VCR, and then that plugged into the camera. And I used to just, you know, make special effects when I was a kid, try to redo stuff I saw in Star Wars or whatever movie I liked. I tried to recreate special effects, make short movies. So I was always playing with cameras. And that stayed with me up until today. But for a long part of my life, my focus was actually more music than image. I played in bands, you know, I toured, I did a lot of stuff until my mid-30s, I guess. And up until that point, I was always kind of the I documented basically always all my bands. So I always had a camera, I always took pictures, I always filmed stuff. So it was always part of who I was to be the guy who took pictures, who made sure that we had visual documents of what was going on. So I have boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes of photos and negatives of all those periods. And like, I mean, I think I know my, you know, I know I'm probably have more images of my bands than they even know that I have. And then I kind of moved into the professional world of image. Oops, sorry about that. I moved into the professional world of image pretty late, actually, like in my mid 30s. I mean, I used to, like, again, I worked in the music industry. I was a music guy. Always keeping images, like photography and video, kind of as a passion thing. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, I was working in the music industry. I lost my job. They cut my position. And then I just had a time to think about what I really wanted to do. And I'm like, well, you know, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be, you know, I studied cinema in school. I mean, the image is supposed to be what I'm doing. So I just said, okay, I have a year of unemployment. Let's get the ball rolling. And I just kind of not conned my way into jobs, but I took jobs that I didn't know how to do, knowing that I had time to learn how to do them before they started. I started editing, and then I just naturally took the camera and then did camera. And then, you know, over the last maybe 6 or 7 years, I qualify myself as a director first, and then a director of photography second, and as a photographer third, but even photographers all around, like it's always been there. Yeah, and so I got to work on a lot of cool stuff. Like, I mean, I went to the Cannes Film Festival for 2 years. I worked on the Anthony Bourdain shows when they came to Montreal, wearing, you know, 2 relatively short but intense periods of time. I probably learned more than I had learned anywhere else. I got lucky to be, well, lucky, I hate that word lucky, but, you know, I had the chance to be quickly taken into the Shoot Studio group, where I had a lot of really, really good mentors. Like, I have, someone I consider a mentor there, Jean-François Graton, and just people that inspire me every day. And then, you know, cameras. I'm a bit of a tech nerd too, so it's
well, that's the thing, right? So we always have our tech conversation, our guitar conversation, and our cameras and art conversation going, you and I. And this is one thing I appreciate from you is that, and this is why you and I are friends, I guess, is because we have that, you know, similar path of liking a certain form of art, which is music, invest in time in it, but then also realizing that there's other form of arts that where you can express yourself, and photography, videography is definitely one of them. But Lucas, you did mention that you picked up a camera, start to tell stories and so on and so forth. What actually made you go to an environment where you actually made it your job, right? So there's always two paths. You can keep it as a passion project, but at some point, some people decide to make it their job. And I want to hear you out on, does it feel sometimes like if it's, you know, mining the other aspect, which is passion driven, the fact that it's your job, or is it actually fueling on the opposite, the fact that it's your job?
For me, it's all fuel. I mean, it's really fun to be able to, I think we're in a time where pretty much everyone who wants to do it can, where I'm doing what I want to do in life. You see people that have jobs and there's never any judgment. Like, some people just need to take care of their families, need to take care of themselves. And they have jobs that if they lost, you know, and got another one, it doesn't have that sort of impact on their life as a part. It's a means to, you know, to take care of your family and stuff like that. And those are all fine. But I'm really doing what I want to do in life. And I mean, I knew that a long time ago, that this is what I wanted to do in life. Like, I mean, I studied this in school. I was gearing up for that. And then sometimes life kind of takes over and things happen that kind of put you down another path. And at some point you kind of like, you know, I started to accept that maybe this wasn't going to happen. And then all of a sudden, like again, the best thing that ever happened was me losing that job and having a door open at an age where like, it's kind of a time to make a choice, and it's just, okay, you know, I'm going to make this happen. So for me, it was born as a passion and became a profession. And they coexist in a way where one inspires the other. Sometimes I work too much. I don't have enough time to do things that, excuse me, that maybe are more creatively, you know, stimulating towards me. I mean, it's normal in my line of work. Like, I do a lot of advertising and a lot of creative stuff as well. I do some TV. There's things that are jobs, and there's things that are cool jobs, and there's some that are just like, wow, I would do this for free if I didn't have to. If I wasn't getting paid, you know, I mean, like a lot of the, I did some like large scale concert filmings, which were just really, really fun to do. And I mean, for me, it was super exciting. I had to learn, you know, 100 pages of classical music sheets and manage 7 cameras across 7 locations on like a lot, like, you know, and it's just, for me, it's like these type of things where it's like a mix of technical and creative and imagination that just, you know, they drive me to really try to be better at what I do. And it's funny, as like it goes along, like, you know, you sort of make a name for yourself, and you know that you'll always have professional work, and you're able to start putting in more time to do your personal stuff. And, you know, I think, you know, the personal stuff is sometimes what defines you a bit more as an artist. But the professional work, you know, is what lets you buy more cameras.
to fill the same... The same disease we have, the gas disease we have,
yeah,
was
it syndrome? But it's fun how they coexist, and like, I mean, I happily balance the two. There's sometimes where I could do 3 months of work that doesn't necessarily inspire me creatively, but it allows me to work on an aspect of something that I haven't done. Like, I did a green screen job a couple years ago, which was, in all honesty, a nightmare of a job. It went on way too long. It wasn't fun and it wasn't cool, but now I can handle green screens, you know, with one hand behind my back, and that's a new tool. So even things that aren't necessarily completely connected to what drives me, I take what I can to make everything else better.
I'll let you have a sip of water. Lika, let's go back to image. So you did mention that you were driven by, you know, capturing engaging images and so on and so forth. I want to bring you into a territory where there's obviously no right answers or wrong answers, but what for you makes a great image, regardless if it's still our moving image?
I think regardless of whether or not there are people involved, I mean, it ties in exactly to the name of your podcast, is there's a story to tell. And I mean, for me, like I have a hard time admiring a picture that's empty. And by empty, it doesn't mean like you could have one thing, you know, one object, but that object tells a story or makes you think about a story or makes you try to imagine what it was. You know, like even like we say yesterday, I haven't looked at the pictures I took, but I went for a walk yesterday, even, you know, just to do some research for a project and was, you know, it wasn't a very nice day. It was gray, still snowy. And as I was walking by Parc Jean-Mance, there was a guy playing soccer in the snow wearing shorts and sneakers and a t-shirt. And it didn't make sense at all. It was cold. It wasn't nice out. It was a gray day. And there's just this guy alone kicking the ball. And I caught a shot of it, you know, and I don't, and again, I'll look at the shot later on. It may be good. It may not be good, but at least it you're intrigued by what this story could be like. Why is this guy there? You know, and sometimes it's a puddle, sometimes it's a tree, sometimes it's a plant, but there's always something, you know. I'm very drawn to story. I'm drawn to lines also. For me, lines tell stories. And I always have to have kind of a master line in my image, which guides you. And I'm naturally pulled towards lines in a strange way. Like if there's not one line that makes sense in my picture, for me, it's something's off. But it's basically story. I mean, it's for me, it's what makes it, what pulls you into a story. And it's what allows everyone to have their own point of view or their own opinion of a photo. If something's too obvious or too blatant what it is, then I don't think there's much room for interpretation. There's not much room for feeling. It might be a perfect photo, but it becomes a technical thing more than an emotional thing. And for me, like it's emotion that drives images, whether it's a little emotion or a big emotion, like something has to kind of get your brain turning in a certain way to make an image work.
Yeah, I love how you said emotion drives image and of course story. So that's the whole point of why we do this. Speaking of visual storytelling, so how do you transfer all that, you know, knowledge and that intention of telling a story into movies, or I know you do music videos and so on and so forth. So how do you bring that creativity into a 24 frames per second constantly for 3 minutes type of medium when, you know, on a single frame, it's a very different experience. And one would say that it might be not easier, but quicker to basically capture a story. But how do you do that for 3 minutes or even, you know, 20 minutes on a short doc or even 2 hours on a movie?
When I worked on the Anthony Bourdain shows the first time, the director of photography was a guy named Zach Zamboni, and he still does a lot of stuff. He's a fantastic guy, and one of the things I admired about that show was how generous he was with information and sharing, like, you know, work tips and how to manage stuff. You know, we had like 17-hour work days to do a lot of stuff, but, you know, I mean, and one of the first things he told me was one. Never hold a shot for less than 10 seconds because it'll be wasted, which is a silly thing to think of, but it forces you to count, take your time, breathe, and then, you know, you get it. And also how just character first, you know, like if you don't care about what's in front of you, you know, no one else will either, or very few people. So, you know, like we'll say, if I take, for example, like the last couple of things I did that I really enjoyed doing that I'm really proud of are the two latest videos from Matt Holubowski for his new record. And basically, you know, when you direct stuff, you're given, it's not always you that comes up with the idea, but you're the one who has to kind of figure out how to make the idea come to life. So I was given an idea. And it's just, you know, you look at what, you know, there's boring things that you have to take into account, like budget, time, how many days you have to shoot, what to get to shoot with, blah, 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 blah. But I forget about those quickly. And the main driving point is, you know, how do I tell this story in an effective way, in a way that people will understand, or in a way that people might not understand, but that'll resonate with them. You know, and again, it's hard. Like the first video I did for him for his new record was a 6.5-minute song where two-thirds of it was instrumental.
Wow.
And that for me was one of the biggest challenges I've had, where a song has its opening, all the emotional punch is in the first third of the song, and then the rest is kind of like this dwindling instrumental part. And it's a very gutsy opening song, single to release. Beautiful song, but I've never had more challenge fitting in story into that. But then again, you take what's in front of you, and then you say, okay, well, this is what we have to tell. And, you know, how much time do I give to this part? How much time do I give to that part? Who can I use to push these things? And who are, like, the characters that I have in front of me? Because I've done a lot of music videos where it's live performances, and that's a whole different story. But when you're working with actors or people that you need to be actors, it's a whole different game of management and storytelling that you have to do. And I'm not shy to say that. I geek out on spec stats and stuff like that. But I remember one of the first things I learned when I was a musician was learn everything to forget it. And it's the same thing I kind of apply to filmmaking or photography. Just everything is there, but you don't need to think about it. And when you don't think about it, that's when you connect to emotions. That's when you connect to a story. And that's when you could really kind of do what you got to do, as opposed to thinking about limitations or, you know, 1 + 3 = 7, then that's my, you know, like any sort of math you got to do to figure out stuff. I mean, I'm super instinctive about everything. So a lot of times, once it comes time to shoot, I'll even throw away everything I planned and just go with what makes sense and what feels right. And oftentimes, you know, to my credit or to my luck, it is, you know, like I find I'm never better than when I trust my instincts fully. And then the second I sort of start second guessing what I do, that's when I regret, or when I feel like I've made a mistake. It might not be a mistake, but it's when I feel like I've made a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, that's so true. And there's something to be said about, you know, it is a very technical type of environment where you deal with cameras and shutter speeds and ISO and all this great stuff. And I don't even want to think about video. It's even more complicated to get things right. But at the end of the day, there's no such thing as a perfect exposure or having a perfect image. That doesn't exist. There's the story you're trying to tell, and sometimes not having an image in focus. And I really invite the listeners to go see the videos that you produced or that you directed, for Matt, because I see a choice, and there are a lot of choices, like having a grainy image, you know, at the beginning. And I really like that. And some other people would say, well, this is not a perfect image. This is not a perfectly clean, and so on and so forth. So I think that is very true what you're saying. And we need to see more of that, right? Because I don't know if you're like me, but we've seen in the past, I would say 10 years, a lot of technician of photography and videography trying to get the best image and the sharpest this and that. And sometimes, you know, if you're doing product photography, yeah, you have to have a sharp image and the product needs to be well lit and so on and so forth. But if you're more, you know, on the artistic side of things, that's what I want to see. I want to see your gut. I want to see the personality of both the artist and the person trying to translate what the artist is, you know, trying to say through their songs or through their painting or whatever whatever you're documenting. So I think there is a space and there is a place. And I start to see more younger, I would say, filmmakers and photographers going to that route. Heck, some people are even ditching digital and going to film. We were having a conversation about it pre-show. But what's your view on that? What's your view of the industry and where it is today and where it's going tomorrow?
Well, let's see. Well, you brought up a good point too, because for me, it's been one of my big internal struggles. Like, I'm a technical person, I said it before, but I'm also a very creative person. You know, like someone kind of made the joke that I'm like half Spielberg and half David Lynch, and it's kind of true in a sense where
this is not a bad mix to have, by the way.
No, and I by no means put myself in their realm of talent, but you know, I'll take it anyway. But like half of me just wants things to be out of focus and fuzzy and soft and grainy, and the other half wants it to be as sharp as possible, as clean as possible. And like I'll use an example. Like I went to, and it's part of where things are going now too, so it's kind of on topic. Like I went to Mexico a couple weeks ago, to Mexico City, and the driving point of the visit was a friend of mine was going on a tour there. And before the pandemic, this friend of mine, I'd played music with him, and he had asked me to play guitar on a tour that was going to Mexico, and then it all got canceled. So we never really got to live that experience. So this time he was going with a band that I wasn't part of. But he said, and you know, I said, well, I don't have my kids those 5 days. I'll go. I'm just going to go. So I left, and like I've been to Mexico City before. I'm comfortable there, but it can be a pretty intense place not necessarily the safest place. So like I recently when I travel, I only bring my film camera. And I just bought my A7R 5. So there was no way I'm bringing that one to, you know, nope. Unsafe territory for now.
Yeah.
I trust myself, and you know, I'm lucky that I'm a 6'6", 230-pound guy who's physically imposing. So I you know, most people won't bother me. But anyway, but I shot like I said, I'll shoot some concert pictures. I put in some like a ISO 3200 film, and I shot some like street shots, and I shot some concert shots, and it was about 10 other people there that were shooting with like digital cameras at the shows. And a couple days later, I saw like on Instagram the photos that were coming out from all these people, and they were like, you know, typical concert shots where they're flash lit, and like you see all the action. And all my shots were ultra low light, ultra noisy,
grainy AF,
grainy triple AF. But you know what? Like they felt like the show. They felt more like what we were living through than anything else. So,
yeah.
It's weird that with all the technology that I love and that I grab onto, for me, I feel more real with a film camera anyway. You know, I just bought the A7R5 and I love it and I use it a lot, but I feel like when I want real stuff, I go to film. And like I shot like some street shots also that were just like noisy as heck, but like beautifully noisy too. And I'm like, you know, this for me feels real. And also like, you know, there's, it's funny because I saw a thing the other day where like the new vintage is like an iPhone 1 that people like are using that to take pictures now. And that's like kind of a new cool thing, which is kind of hilarious because like for us, you know, I think for us like digital noise isn't the same feeling as film grain.
Yeah.
But for this generation, like digital noise is the film grain. So it's kind of neat that like this idea of imperfection is good. I think it's healthy because, you know, perfection in every sense of the word doesn't exist. And it's an unhealthy thing to strive for also physically or realistically, because, you know, what's perfect for you, I might think is, okay, it's nice. What's perfect for me, you might think is beyond perfect or just meh. You know, it's art is personal. So this idea of perfection doesn't matter. You know, it's more, do you believe in it? Do you feel it's right? So for me, like what's right is, you know, capturing moments in a real and authentic way that tell stories. And, you know, recently I find like that just the way film is, the way you use film forces you to kind of go down that road too. And I kind of feel like it's catching on everywhere in a certain sense. Like I see more, I see less like perfect things and more real things. And it feels good to see that too. You know, whether I connect with it or not, it's just kind of refreshing to see people opening themselves up to being normal or accepting reality as it is.
Well, as a proof point, I think Kodak actually catch that drift because they are jacking up the price of film. So yeah, so we're not dreaming Jesus, about this. It's really it's really happening. By the way, that photo of it's called Random Alley on we'll put your Instagram in the show notes. Wow, that's such a great photo, and for all the reasons that you just stated, this is, you know, bringing us into a instant mindset, instant mood, and also the way you capture that guy in that alley and mm-hmm. that grain, man. This is a serious grain check moment, and I'm loving it. I'm loving every single point of grain in it.
There's a photographer that I admire a lot, and he passed away this year, but his name was George Zimbel. And he's a Canadian photographer, but Canadian American, he saw everything and he was everywhere. Like he was a photographer for the New York Times. He photographed like JFK. He was a very renowned street photographer, a fascinating guy, and he was at the place where there was a famous Marilyn Monroe shot with her dress going up, he was the photographer that decided that what was more interesting than Marilyn Monroe was how everyone was looking at Marilyn Monroe. And he's the guy who actually took a step back and took a picture of the crowd taking the pictures. And that's what became iconic in the end, is not just her, is what was around it. So it's things like that for me make a difference, is kind of, you know, where should your intention really be, or what tells the best story? And for that photo, the best story wasn't Marilyn Monroe. It was how there was a bazillion people trying to get the shot of just her. And the best shot was actually the shot of the guys taking the shot.
Yeah. And to your point, if there's, you know, 105 photos of Marilyn Monroe on that thing with the dress, but there's only one of the crowd actually being, you know, doing what they do, that's that that becomes the photo that's important. Of course, the other photo is interesting and it's everywhere and probably sold out multiple times for a couple of photographers. But the one that tells the full story is when you put both together. So I like what you're saying. Exactly. Speaking of you know, using your gear when you travel and so on and so forth, so some listeners like to know what the creators are using. You mentioned a couple things, so you're a Sony, I wouldn't say fanboy, but you like your Sonys. That's something we discussed multiple times, but you also like film. So what do you shoot on, and more interestingly, why? Why do you decide to go with these type of tools? Again, this is not a gear show, but we're always interested in learning what tools the creators use to tell their stories.
Well, to rapidly get to the Sony stuff, you know, as a video guy, I mean, my main cameras are Sony. I've been Sony cameras for a while. Like, I followed them through from like F3s to FS7s to, and I own an FX9 now. So instinctively, you know, to have matched cameras, I've always kind of used Sony photo cameras. And I've, you know, some people find their menus god awful, and I just kind of so used to them that for me they're not problematic. And I mean they're really good cameras. They're not too bulky. They do what I want them to do. But again, recently I've just sort of shifted towards when I travel. And recently I've traveled. I mean, I picked up travel since the pandemic ended. I like. I don't even consider it limitations, but I like what sort of street, you know, a film camera forces me down. So I had a Pentax K1000 for a while that I picked up just like that. And then when I went to Chicago last year, I decided to give it to a friend of mine. And the first place I went to when I was in Chicago, I said, okay, I'll find some camera shots. I'll buy a new camera. And then I went to like a record store because where I was staying was near a couple of vinyl shops and stuff like that. And I walk in and they had like 6 cameras on sale.
Wow.
So then I Googled quickly, you know, each model. And one of them was the Minolta XD11, which was actually... it was kind of co-produced with Leica in a sense. So like the body is actually kind of like a Leica body, but in a Minolta name. So it actually has lots of Leica properties, and it was like $100. So I said, okay, you know, it was a good deal. It was very well reviewed. So I took that, and again, blind buy, never tested it. Shot my whole week in Chicago. I went, and there was a Photoshop there on Michigan Avenue, and they had bucket loads of film before it got too expensive too, or at least there it wasn't as expensive. So I bought a whole bunch of film that I never used, like black and white color. And just spent the whole week shooting it with the camera. And like, I know there's a couple, it's funny. There was like, I think there's like a couple shutter speeds where the door doesn't close properly, but even that gave me cool shots. So once I'll do more tests and figure out what it is, but that's kind of been my new friend for now, is at the Minolta. And then, my daughter has music classes in Verdun, every Monday night, and on the corner of Wellington and de l'Église, there's a Salvation Army there.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't give away my secret because it's a, and I go every Monday, and every Monday there's new stuff. And like every 3 or 4 weeks, there's a bunch of cameras that show up. And I always look, and then like I bought another one, which was like a Canon T90, which is like a fully automatic film camera that makes a crazy amount of noise when it winds the film. So I'm still mid-roll on that one, so I'm going to see how that one comes out. But like, you know, I just kind of like having choices.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually I count on going to that Salvation Army and there being 5 Leicas there for $20.
Well, if that happens, but I remind you that I live close by to that place, so that won't happen. Sorry, Luca.
I'll call you.
Or we'll have to share. We'll have to share.
Well, again, yeah. If there's more than one, I'll call you and you could have the other one.
Okay.
But like one time I went and there was like three 8mm film cameras and a bunch of projectors.
Nice.
And it was like, I should have bought them all because they were like $20 and I didn't do it. So that I regret. But so I'm always kind of on the lookout. Like I like kind of exploring cameras. And again, my goal this year is to kind of upgrade and really get to become a Leica junkie like you, obviously.
Well, I'm, so that's my people next, can't see it, but I'm holding the camera that Luca should have, which is an M6.
I see it.
but again, it's yes, there is this whole trend, of course, and film is, you know, getting expensive to develop and then to process. And but hey, you can develop your, if you like black and white. I mean, I'm looking at your images from Mexico. You could have developed it at home, and you can keep it on the budget side. You can buy bulk in bulk in terms of the film, and you can do it yourself type of situation. Yeah. You can even scan them with you've got a pretty nice Sony with 60 five whatever megapixels, 66. So I think that's enough to scan
that's
afterwards.
True. I could use that to scan those.
Yeah,
and then,
exactly. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Cool stuff. But
the one thing I like the most about film, though, is also is and that's maybe me because of my age or where I came from and my background, but I find like digitally, the stuff I shoot digitally stays on the computer, and the stuff I shoot on film, I tend to print and I tend to take more care of, and I tend to like cherish a bit more. Like I have, you know, like a wall of photos in my apartment from like travels, and it's and unknowingly, it's only the film ones that I ended up printing. Like there's a certain richness to them, you know, and it ties back to like why 24 frames per second is the frame, like is the ideal frame rate for movies. It's because it's enough frames to make the image fluid, but not enough frames to make it life. And you're just always transported somewhere else. You know, you're always transported into a moment that's not real. So that's why, like, I can't stand high frame rate movies. They make me sick. Anything like over 30 frames for me doesn't make sense, because it's, you're not taken away. You know, the whole point of a movie is to be taken away. And sometimes the whole point of a photo is to be taken away. So for me, grain makes those moments sort of nostalgic. Like I've even started shooting with my digital camera with the monitor closed. I don't look at playback. I just shoot my pictures. And I make sure, you know, I have confidence in my exposure and my technical skills, and I just leave the LCD off, and I'll walk around and shoot, and then I'll develop it.
Yeah.
When I get home.
Well.
For better or for worse.
Well, you will be happy to know that there is a Leica for that. It's called a Leica MD, and it doesn't have a screen in the back. Okay, so this is not a Leica show. We should go back to visual storytelling.
It kind of is.
Yeah, sometimes. That's my fault. So speaking of cinema, is there do you take a lot? I'm sure I know the answer to that, but I want the listeners to deep dive a bit on that front. How is cinema or films influencing, you know, your day-to-day inspiration, but also even your work—the work you do with shoot.
I think a lot of my framing mindset comes from cinema. I consider myself a very good framer. Like I know how to frame people, I know how to frame images, and I'm very fast at framing, and that comes from, I think, you know, watching movies, and sometimes I watch movies purely just for the cinematography. During the pandemic, Roger Deakins, who was one of my favorite directors, yep, cinematographers, who did like a lot of Denis Villeneuve's latest work. He did a lot of Coen Brothers movies and stuff like that. Yeah, he started a podcast, and he was just so open about sharing information and how he works. And you know, sometimes the simplicity of things that you think would be complicated. But all these things kind of work in my mind. Like I was watching, this week I watched, I'd seen it before, but I just wanted to watch it for the cinematography, The Batman, the latest one Matt Reeves did with Robert Pattinson. And the cinematography is gorgeous in that movie. At one point I read things, you know, they use like these weird funky Russian lenses, or the Helios 44-2s. So I think, you know, I bought one of those off eBay, got it shipped from the Ukraine.
Everything is bokalicious.
And it just has... Oh, Jesus. I mean, just round on the edges, and this has this weird 70s color vibe to it, like a very Chernobyl-y color vibe. And there's something really special about it. And they use those in specific scenes. And, you know, it's about framing, how to tell stories in frames too, and when what serves and what doesn't, you know. And I'm especially when it comes to film work, or my directing work, is like, there's a difference between a beautiful shot and a beautiful shot that serves a story. And the line is sometimes very thin, you know, like there's nothing I hate more than movies that have gorgeous shots that don't mean anything apart from being gorgeous. Like if I'm saying, oh, wow, that's so nice looking, and I'm forgetting about the story, then the shot isn't beautiful. I mean, it will make a nice demo reel. But for me, everything has to serve whatever it is. And I mean, if I'm doing an ad for orange juice, then I mean, you know, it has to serve the orange juice. But if I'm doing something like for something more creative and something more visual, then whatever I'm doing has to serve that too. And I mean, you always have to keep in check, you know, if it's beautiful, or if you're aiming towards making a beautiful shot, well, is it serving what your purpose is, the story you're trying to tell? And for me, those things are super duper important too. So I watch a lot of movies from directors of photography that I respect and admire to really find the balance between storytelling and making things that are visually interesting too, because, you know, you can mix the two, but one can't suffer from the other.
Yeah, I agree. And I bet you're a bit like me, and you take your inspiration, yes, from cinema and from art forms that are close to photography, but also music, right? So there's this thing in my head where a photo, there'll be a soundtrack attached to it. I don't know if it's the same for you, but I cannot help it. It's just the way my brain is wired. I cannot look at an image without thinking about a song or a part of a lyric of a song or something like that. So I don't know. I think we're the same on that front.
I have a soundtrack for when I brush my teeth.
Well, there you go.
Much music accompanies me in life. You know, like, I mean, this, before I wake up, like the first thing I do when I wake up, no matter where I am, is go for coffee. But even before the coffee is, I put on music to get me out of bed to making my coffee. I mean, I have music for every period of life or every idea. Like, for, you know, music for me is as much a driving element, even if it's not even present in the final image, you know, but I hear stuff all the time, and music is integral too. So, like, I mean, you know, yesterday when I was walking around taking pictures, you know, I specifically picked music to walk around with. And I often listen to movie music, actually. That's one of my things that inspires me a lot too, is sometimes music without lyrics. So I'm a big collector of soundtracks. So I listen to a lot of movie soundtracks. So, you know, like a lot of times, like yesterday, it was kind of grim outside. So I put on the soundtrack to Interstellar by Hans Zimmer. And it's kind of very brooding and a slow build and very deep, you know. And it just kind of gave me this drive. And I just started looking at things a bit differently. And, you know, but had I put on, I don't know, like Weezer, then I would have been like jumping around and looking for happy people. Or, you know, like, it influences me and what I'm looking for. So I put myself in a mood too. And music is key to everything. I mean, there's music playing until like 3 seconds before I fall asleep every day.
Yep, that's same here. So I guess this is why we have so much to talk about when we exchange when we're in person or through all the platforms that we're on. Speaking of platforms, Lucas, so you're a working professional, and as you said, you know, you don't always have time to, like, you know, do personal projects and so on and so forth. What's your view on social media? I like asking this question because it's a very contentious, I would say, point, and a lot of people have a different perception of it and use of it. And I would throw in a second aspect of this question. What would you say to a young person who's entering that creative realm and wants to make this a job, and how should or shouldn't they pay attention to what's happening on social media?
See, I have a very conflicted relationship with social media. Like, there's certain things that I love about it, and there's a lot of things that I really don't like about it. I sometimes have to force myself to use it. Like, if you look at my Instagram, you'll see, like, sometimes there's like a lapse of like 9 months without pictures. Like for me, social media is a communication tool. And again, it's to share. I sort of decided to make it more about visual things that inspire me. Like, I rarely, if ever, put personal, like, family moments. Like, I never show my kids on Instagram. It's a choice I made a little while ago. Or if I do, like, it's like, I think I put one photo of my kids when they were helping me do the Matt Halabowski video. Like, they were my helpers, and I took a picture of them from behind. And I mean, I have no problem with people that do differently, but for me, that's kind of like my choice about social media. Is like, I find that things can stay too long, or, you know, it's there's a whole this deal about it. Do people really want to be there or not? Like, you know, but for professionally, I mean, it really is the best way for people to see your work right now. It's a good way to have people kind of share and comment on things that you've done also, you know, like, to see how people react to things that you do. Because again, since everything is kind of, you know, we live in a world where, like, you know, see all the videos that I made, they're not on TV now, they're on social media.
Yeah.
So for me to see how people connect to it, it's like reading comments on YouTube, reading comments on Instagram, you know, reading comments on Facebook. So, I mean, whether I like it or not, that's how things get around. Like, no one watches, there's no more Music Plus, there's no, and even to in a different way, like, if it was on Music Plus, you would have no feedback at all, because it's a
one-way conversation
environment. So it's a nice thing to be able to, like, you know, I've had people after videos write me, you know, like, how did you do this and how did you do that shot? You know, like the plane shots in the Matt Halabowski video were really fun to do, and I had my way of doing them. And a couple of people asked me about, like, that. So, like, there's something really fun about it. But I mean, like, I got my door open in this business because at that time I was with my ex, and she saw on Twitter someone saying, hey, I'm looking for an editor for this project. Do you know anyone? And she's like, okay, call her, like, write her right now. I'm like, yeah. She goes, no, do it right now. Because she was much more social media friendly than I was. So I wrote back. I got the job without, you know, really having to prove much, luckily, because I had no idea what I was doing. But I knew that I had a month to get before, like, they were going to shoot the images, you know? It was like, they were, like, really recruiting ahead of time. So I spent a month researching YouTube and da-da-da-da and got good enough to do the job well enough to get more jobs and more jobs and more jobs. So, like, I owe my career to a certain extent to social media, because it was, you know, and that's how things work now. So I think you have to embrace it. I think you have to decide quickly, though, how you want to use it. Because sometimes, like, it's, if you decide that it's going to be a professional thing, and then all of a sudden you start putting photos of cats for 3 weeks and you go back to professional, like, you could confuse people. You have to kind of decide what image you want to project and how you want to project it. So, like, I've decided for me, like, my photo feed of Instagram will say alternates between, you know, street photography that I'm proud of, or photography that I've done, and, like, sort of screen captures from videos. That, like, it's a professional thing, but it's very personal as well. Like, it's kind of a weird mix, but, you know, if you go back for, like, the last 3, maybe 4 years, that's pretty much a pattern that I have, you know, like, but I'm the worst person at tooting my own horn. Like, I really sometimes over rely on other people doing it. So I'm trying to get better at that. But, like, I recently, you know, I make a point of sharing interesting things when I'm working. Like, I do, like, you know, like, setups, you know, sort of behind the scenes stuff, just to remind people that I work sometimes. And again, sometimes it inspires questions and comments. You know, if they see lighting setups or you know, I'm lucky that I work with a lot of interesting people. Yesterday I was shooting a documentary and I got to, like, you know, shoot interviews with Michel Rivard and Marcel Sabourin, who, for people who know who he is, is still, you know, a very well-respected actor from a certain generation of Quebec. And a film directed by his son, who is Jérôme Sabourin, who was one of the best cinematographers, not just here, but anywhere. Fantastic person. So I got to learn from him a lot too. So yes, it's an essential tool. I mean, it's the way that work and content is shared. I just think it took me a while to figure it out and how to kind of make it my own and how to be comfortable with it. And it's weird because sometimes I have my rules and sometimes I break them. Like, you know, every once in a while, I'll just kind of write, like, personal stuff, or I'll put a picture of a record I'm listening to, which is generally contrary to what I'm doing, but sometimes my mood inspires it. So I'm strict, but I kind of let myself slip every once in a while, and I'm okay with that.
Well, I guess rules are meant to be broken. That's how I see it.
I agree.
Luca, what's next for you? So what projects actually are you working on, or something you have, like, you know, mid to long term? Because, yeah, social media is great to share an instant or a moment, but are you driven also by long term projects? Just so you know, I literally this morning, I woke up at like 4:30. That's another issue that I have. I wake up way too early, and I started to think, what am I doing? What am I doing with like posting images and then getting a certain amount of likes? And, oh yeah, great image. I need to be working on a long term project. And so I decided to start looking at the body of work and going back. I started shooting in 208, like, more seriously. So I have tons of images. Most of them are crap, but a couple of them are okay. So, and I started to notice, you know, some themes in there. So my question to you is, are you also driven by long-term projects like I just described? And what would be your next one?
It's funny because, I mean, we realize that we're in sync for a lot of things. And this year and more recently, over the last few weeks, during the summer, I usually work on I direct parts of Sucré Salé, which is a cultural TV show here during the summer. And I don't think I'm going to do it this summer. So it's the first time in 7 years that my summer is kind of free. But it also allowed me to have sort of that space of mind to say, you know, who am I really as an artist? And I realized that, you know, this year my goal this year, I always give myself a goal at the beginning of every year. And like last year, my goal was to master color correction to be a better color corrector for my videos, because I found I'd hit a plateau. And so I spent all year last year doing research, trying things, and I regraded all my old stuff. And it's just like, wow. So this year it's to really kind of forge an identity where if people hear my name, then there's certain things that come to mind firsthand. So it's a year where I've kind of prepared myself to maybe work a bit less professionally, to have more time personally to be a better professional down the road. Like, I mean, I have clear ambitions. Like, I want to do fictional work. I love directing actors, and I've been lucky because of my work where I've got to meet and I have good relationships with a lot of really, really strong talent, really good actors. Like, I did a project that if you scroll down my Instagram, you'll see there's a bunch of black and white photos that kind of tell a certain story. There's like a video compliment to that one. and I was directing a bunch of actors doing scenes where the whole goal of it was to direct them where they had scripts and things to act, but there was no sound recorded. So it was all based on acting. And that was a lot of fun to do. And that sort of made me realize that fiction is something that I've been kind of leaning towards slowly, but I think it's time to kind of put the gas on that idea and put myself in a position where someone would be ready to take a chance to give me something like that. Because it's obviously, you know, it doesn't come out of nowhere. You have to kind of, but people do give chances to people. And I think I have a good enough relationship with people at large and a good enough reputation for that if, you know, things could happen. So I'm really gearing myself up towards working on me, my identity, and kind of creating these personal projects with this kind of new time that I haven't had recently to really forge a better identity. Like, I've been writing a movie for the last like 4 years, and maybe I might like, you know, go to Mexico for 2 weeks and just write, whether it's good or not. Like, I mean, you don't get better unless you practice. And like, you know, generally speaking, your first script isn't going to sell a movie. So, and you know, I say it half joke or one third jokingly, like I'm getting old sort of, so I'm not a kid anymore, but I mean, it's never too late to change things around. Like, I saw yesterday just by coincidence, you know, it was a reminder, like, you know, Bourdain didn't start doing his TV shows until he was 45. So I'm 46, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, it's a job where, like, you know, the age doesn't necessarily have to stop you. Like, you know, I might stop running around with the camera as crazy as I am now, but like, I won't stop having ideas. And so I'm really working on cementing who I am as an artist and really discovering, you know, where I want to go down the line. And it's kind of exciting too, because I've been lucky that I've never had to look for work for the last like 5, 6, 7 years. I've just always had a full table. Like, as soon as something finishes, something else starts. Like, I have regular clients. I do a lot of work for the Théâtre du Nouveau Monde. Like, I had Sucre Salé. I have regular musical work. I do, you know, I have my corporate clients that are regular. So like, my years sometimes are kind of filled before they start, which is comforting, but it always ends up getting to the point where it gets too filled and I don't have enough time for me. So this is kind of a me year. And I'm kind of excited to see what it'll do, because I don't think as a professional I've had the space of mind to think this much about what I want to do. So it's kind of exciting.
Well, that's very exciting and inspiring for, you know, other artists who might want to invest time into their craft and into, you know, their own personal project. It is possible. You have to work your ass off for, you know, 10, 20 years, but it is possible at some point to take a step back and also, you know, invest time in yourself, in your own growth. And that's something that I hope this podcast is giving, you know, the listeners hope about, because sometimes can get into, you know, a mindset where you just work, and then you don't even know why you're doing it. But conversations like the one we're having this morning is very, very interesting and gives hopes to people. So I like that. So, Luca,
I do too.
I really want to thank you for your time this morning. It's been very, very, very interesting conversation. Again, we are friends, so we talk a lot about this, but I think there's a lot of value for the listeners, because you are a very talented person. You're a very kind person, very generous person, but also people can learn from you. If people want to learn more about your work, where should they go to learn more about the Luca Rupnik work?
I mean, the place where people will probably see the most stuff coming by is on my Instagram. So it's at Lucas Rupnik, simply. A lot more stuff is going to be coming through Shoot Studio, also shootstudio.ca, since I do a lot of work through them. But my main communication vehicle is Instagram, I think. Like, I don't see myself on TikTok anytime soon or anything like that, but that's okay. But I share more on Instagram than on Facebook. That's where I have most of my interactions with people who ask me questions and are curious about things, which is another fun thing, is to being able to talk to people and kind of share ideas. You know, I give conferences on photo from time to time, and I get a lot of feedback from those, and it kind of makes me rethink about things too. So I guess if there's anywhere to go, it'd be the Instagram, and that's where any new work that I do will show up. I'm always open to chat with people too. It's fun. I think one of the good things about a podcast like this is that it you know, it makes you see people that you wouldn't necessarily have crossed paths with, or at least listen to them, and then it opens the doors to different fields of work and different ways of seeing things. And I think that's the most interesting thing too, is, you know, you just, I mean, it's a job where, I don't like saying the word job, it's a field where, you know, the more you see, the more you inspire, and it's you know, it's never ending. And it's a beautiful thing that there's always going to be, like, I'll see something tomorrow that I've never seen before that'll just kind of like blow me away. You know, it's like finding a record that came out in 1971 that you've never heard, and all of a sudden, like, it's your new favorite song of all time. Like, it's been there the whole time, and just for some reason you never cross paths with it. And sometimes people are like that too.
Well, thank you so much, Luca.
Really cool thing.
This is very, very cool. And you can rate this podcast if you like it. Give it a 5-star review. And I've been Fred Ranger. Please enjoy life.